praise due to Allah, and our peace and blessings be on the last messenger of Allah. As the brother has introduced the topic, did God become man? This particular topic is, in my opinion, the essence of what the da'wah has to cover, what it has to tackle and make clear to people. Some people may say, well, when Prophet Muhammad sallam sent Mu'adh ibn Jabal to Yemen, he told him to tell the people Tawheed, Yuwahidullah. The issue of did God become man is Tawheed. It's not Tawheed in its totality, it covers everything, but much of what the message of Tawheed addresses is also addressed in this particular question. Did God become man? Because when we look at all of the various religions around the world, and we look at Islam and the unique concept that Islam has of God, we will find that the vast majority of the religions all trip over this point of God becoming man. People worship the creation instead of the creator. And by nature, they tend to worship what they perceive as being the highest form of nature, which is man. Even when they're worshipping other beings in creation, you will find there is a link between man and that being. And in worshipping man, ultimately, man worships himself. Now, if we take for granted that the belief held by the major religions about God is generally the same, we can say, as I began, that that belief held in Islam is unique amongst the views of God. It's unique not only in its concept, how God is perceived, but also in the fact that the concept of God has not evolved. God was God and remains God, unchanged in its concept. And we believe, as Muslims, that the understanding of God, Tawheed, which Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, brought, was not a new understanding. Social anthropologists have a way of explaining that monotheism evolved, having concluded that man originally came from an ape-like ancestor. We talked about that earlier. This is what social anthropologists, they have this concept. Psychologists, psychiatrists, they're all sharing this general concept. far as they can perceive it. Then they concluded that man created God. God is a figment of man's imagination. Some of them, Freud, Durkheim, and others, they have proposed theories as to how did man arrive at the worship or the creation of the concept of God. Freud put forth the idea of it coming out of the Oedipal complex, wherein he creates a scenario saying that the early human beings, man, his wife, woman, children, that the children, the male children, they loved their mother and were jealous of the father. This is the Oedipal complex. And in their jealousy, they killed their father. Now the father was the provider who went out, hunted, and provided for the family. So once they killed him, they had no provider. No protector. The head, one was looking out for them. So they created this imaginary head who would provide and protect them. Modern mythology that's found in psychiatry and psychology. This is what they're teaching. People who go into these fields, they don't know. Each school has its own explanation as to how belief in God evolved or began. So, the others, the social anthropologists, when they analyze religion as a whole, they say it evolved, you see. Early man, when he saw around him the forces of nature, lightning, flashing trees, you know, thunder, earthquakes, all these things, powerful forces of nature. Fear, he was in fear of these forces. And in his tribal circumstance, the head of the tribe is usually the strongest one. This is who he is. He's the most powerful guy, you know. He can beat up everybody else. Everybody else has to submit to him. So what he does then, before they all used to go out and hunt, but because he is the strongest, he doesn't have to go out and hunt. He beats up everybody else and they have to go out and hunt. When they hunt, they take some for their family. They must take some to give to him. Right? This is their offerings to him to win his pleasure. If he is pleased with them, he won't beat them up. Right? So this is the beginnings of the idea of the offerings to the gods. So in the same way as they rationalize, you know, we appease our tribal chief by giving offerings to him, then these powerful forces of nature, who now they are, you know, gave images of being some kind of god, they would try to appease them by making the sacrifice and so on, offer it to the lightning god, and to the thunder god. And in the early days, you know, of the earth, of course there were many tribes, and each tribe had its own little version of these gods, who the gods were, what they looked like, and that type of thing. And they would, you know, make images, usually, which were human-like images. Now, as tribes came in contact with other tribes, certain tribes would overcome with defeat and beat up the other tribes, you know, kill their men, enslave their women, you know, take their children, this type of thing, or make them as vassals under them. They would have to pay tributes or whatever back to their. And what would happen is that this particular tribe that sort of beaten up these other tribes and defeated them and gained control over them, their gods, they would give up and accept the gods of this conquering tribe. That's because these gods.
gods, and the conquering tribe must be the real gods, because they help that tribe conquer everybody else. These are the more powerful gods. So, as time is progressing now, see, from tribes, from individual families, tribes are being formed, and tribes are turning into nations as they conquer other tribes. In that process, the number of gods are decreasing, till they reach the point of two gods, right, which is the example given of the god of good and the god of evil. They decrease their numbers down till they reach the point of two gods, and then eventually the last step from that was to go to one god. So the process of evolution as they portray it. And then they take examples of peoples around in the world today and use them as examples of the different stages. You see, they take the North American Indians and other tribal peoples of animists, etc., found in Africa, in South America, in Philippines, different parts of the world. You have people who are animists. They worship nature and the forces of nature. They say, okay, this is an example of that stage. Then they go to the Indians, Hindus. This show the Hindus, they have personal gods, many personal gods. Each family has their own god. It's an example of that stage. Then they go down to the dual, this is the Persian, right? The Zoroastrian, belief, Parsis. They have god of good, god of evil, light and dark. Fire was symbolic of the god of light, who's the god of good. And then Judaism, and they include with it Christianity as an example of arriving at monotheism. Of course, for us this is nonsensical, because like the people trying to prove evolution, they have a theory already which they've now gone into the circumstances and just put evidence to support their theory. But actually, if one looks at the history, it's not like that. There was a time in Egypt when Egyptians arrived at the worship of one god, known as Ra. They used the sun as a symbol. I forgot the name of this particular pharaoh. Huh? Oh, Akhenaten, yes. He is the one, and in his period of time, it was about the worship of one god. After him, they went back to the worship of a number of gods. And if we look at the stage from Judaism to Christianity, we don't see polytheism to monotheism. What we see is monotheism to polytheism. Jews believe in one god, Christians made in three. So it's going in the other direction. Corruption here. So the Islamic view is that Adam believed in one god. This was the same belief from Abraham, Moses, etc., etc., right down to the last of the prophets, Muhammad. May God's peace and blessings be on all of them. And that it was people deviating from the teachings of the prophets that produced these beliefs in other gods. Sometimes they degenerated to polytheism, to animism, where they worship nature. Sometimes they degenerated to tritheism, like that of the Christians, or to dualism, like that of the Parsis. Now these are just varying shades of degeneration of belief, as they deviated from the main path. But the concept of God, as presented by Islam in the final form, we believe was not an evolved concept, but a constant. It was a concept held by Abraham and Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon them, and on all those in between. Now, if we look at the major religions in the world today, usually when people get to look at the major religions that have gods and so on, so they include Judaism. I'm not going to include Judaism. I mean, if the world population is some 3.5 or 4 billion people, and the Jews' total population is someplace around 10 million, what is the point in looking at the Judaism? Huh? joking, 40 million more. You know, what is the point? What is 40 million in 4 billion? Nothing. A drop in the ocean. The numbers of Hindus, you know, this is a number now. This is a number. 800 million. So we're going to look at world religion. This is what we have to look at. Look at the Hindus. Look at the Christians. And look at Muslims. So, as we look at Christianity, or let's look at Hinduism first. Look at Hinduism. What we see in Hinduism is the concept that everything is God. This is the basis of Hindu concepts of God. That everything ultimately is God. They have a dual principle which they call Atman Brahman. Atman refers to the self or the soul, the self of all things. Brahman refers to the universal soul, God. That Atman, this individual self, individual human beings as well as animals and everything, this is a part of Brahman. So in the end what you're saying is that everything is really God. What they portray is that God, from God, human beings split off, you could say, or came into being. Some came into being from his head, this is the Brahmin class, upper caste. Some from his arms and body, some from his legs, and then some from his feet, the Shudras at the very bottom. You know, the untouchables coming after them. The society is divided up into castes, depending on which part of God you were created from. And their belief is that human being strives to reach a stage where he becomes one with God again in the end of the whole process. His life is a life on a wheel, the wheel of reincarnation. When he dies, he is reincarnated. He comes back into the life again, another body. If he was good in this life, his karma, good karma, then, when he is reborn, he moves up a notch, right? Up, the notches, these are the castes. Because you have four major castes, but then they have thousands of sub-castes. So you move up notch by notch by notch. Each time, you're a good boy. Now, if you weren't good, then you may be reborn, you know, as a lizard, right? Or a dog, you know? Or some other animal, a fly. This is why, you know, those that are very strict, they're strict vegetarians. This is what it's about. Because you may be eating your grandfather. So it's like a very interesting thing about eating meat, you know. You know? So this is their concept. This is also why suicide for them is really easy. I know there in Dubai, we have a huge portion of Hindus that are there working. And almost every day you read in the newspaper some Hindu ties a noose around the ceiling fan. I mean, you know, they find him there, his wife there. You know, life gets tough. Let's take another try. Easy for them to just tuck it in and come back again, right? This is their basic belief. Now, so as we said, the people, you know, working your way up the ladder, and in the end you reach the Brahmin class, then when you die at that point, you reabsorbed by Brahman, world soul. This they call moksha. And in Buddhism it's called nirvana. At that point you become one back with the universal God. So their whole religion, philosophy, philosophically requires man to realize that he in fact is God. And all of this so-called new wave religions, we talk about the new age religions, they call them, right? New age religions. People like Shirley MacLaine and others that are involved in, you know, a variety of different versions of the new age religions, all of it goes back to this idea that man is God. Realizing that you are God. Reincarnation is a common theme amongst them all. You know, you get hypnotized, go back to your previous life. You know, in my previous life I was a this and a that, and all these stories that they're relating. All of this is back to the idea of reincarnation, and that man fundamentally is God. Now, at the same time that they have this basic belief, the concept of the universal God and his powers as a preserver, you know, as a destroyer, as a creator, these attributes of God, they portray as different gods, separate gods. And this is where you get the so-called Hindu Trinity. Now, among them, one of the most popular of the gods is Vishnu. And Vishnu, they believe, becomes incarnate at different points in time. The incarnations they call avatars. You hear this term? The avatar means the God-man, the man who is in fact God living amongst us. From time to time, there are different Hindus who will claim that they're avatars, you know, gurus who reach a certain stage to claim they're avatars. But traditionally, they believe that there were 10 major appearances of Vishnu, you know, in creative form, in the form of creation. They give them a variety of different names, the appearances, and they're related to the forms. Among them, just to give you an idea of the kind of things that they're talking about, one of the first appearances of Vishnu is called Matsya, which is Vishnu appearing as a fish. And the fish takes on holy characteristics, and Vishnu is represented as a fish and becomes an object of worship. He also became manifest or incarnate as Kurma, which is a tortoise, turtle. You know, so the tortoise has, you know, becomes formed for God for them to worship. And then has a variety of other things. They got, you know, as a wild pig and a variety of half lion, half man. And then you hear of Rama and Krishna. You know, the Hare Krishnas, you hear about Hare Krishna. The Rama and Krishna, these represent human incarnation of Vishnu. Now, the concept here is of God becoming man. In Christianity, there is a similar concept, though it doesn't promote the idea of God being everything. Right? In fact, they consider this to be pantheism, and they reject it. They do promote the idea that the human soul is divine. It's a general belief held that the human soul is divine. But in specific terms of God becoming man, this is expressed in the concept of Jesus, who was a man, being God. And it is expressed in the Gospels, in John in particular, the beginning of which, in which it says, in the beginning was the Word. Right? And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. And it goes on, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among men. This is the term which is used for words in the Gospels, this particular Gospel, because it's written in Greek, is logos. And if you go back to the to Greek philosophy and look at their concept of God, this concept of a universal soul-like being that reflected on itself and its thoughts, you know, became other beings, and you know, the logos plays the role of the intermediary between the universal God and man. And the problem which leads them to this belief is the problem in understanding how God could create from nothing. How God could create from nothing. Because human beings, in our world, when we create, what we do is we actually manipulate. When we make a table, we are manipulating the wood. We have to cut down the tree, we shape it, put it here. You know, we melt some rocks, take out iron, we make nails and screws, put it together. So we're manipulating nature. We're making and creating things from things which already existed. So they find themselves in a situation where they cannot conceive of how God would create from nothingness. So the easy way to understand it is of God creating from himself. That he took himself to make the creation. That's why he ends up in some of their philosophies being inside of everything. And this is an old philosophy actually. The ancient Greeks, Plato in particular, wrote about this, that human beings represented portions of God which were trapped in matter, and that the purpose of life here was to realize that that portion inside matter was actually God, and that we would do a series of exercises, you know, spiritual, philosophical, logical exercises we would do to liberate our spirit from the material body, so that the spirit could rejoin with its origin, God. Now, this idea, coming from both the Hindu channel as well as the Greek philosophical channel, ended up amongst Muslims. A large portion of Muslims subscribe to a set of beliefs which are grouped together under the general heading of Sufism. And what you find in the various branches of Sufism is that the effort and the purpose of life for the Sufi is fana. Fana is disappearance in God, becoming one again with God. And the various exercises that they prescribe, the various tariqahs, each one has their own set of exercises that you do, you know, some of them it's just repetition, some of them involve moving your head certain ways, some involve dancing, you know, the whirling dervishes, you know, variety of different forms. They believe that these different exercises will help you to liberate, you know, yourself from the material and allow your divine portion to become again one with God. Same philosophy. Of course, it's been cloaked in Islamic terminology, and even verses from the Quran have been drawn out to support it. They will point and say, well, you know, Allah said when he created Adam that he blew in Adam from his spirit. فَنَفَخَ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِهِ. There it is. Adam's spirit, the spirit which is inside of Adam, was a part of Allah's spirit. The basis of that philosophy. And of course, each human being who came out is carrying a piece of that spirit. So there's a piece of Allah in each and every one of us. Of course, this argument is a false argument. In my book, Fundamentals of Tawheed, I've gone into it in detail and, you know, broken it apart and shown. That's basically just a summary that when Allah said that he blew into Adam from his spirit, this is not taken literally to mean that Allah actually blew a portion of his own spirit into Adam. Because we don't believe that Allah has a spirit. Spirit is created. As Allah said when they asked you about the ruh, the ruh is in amri rabbi, by Allah's command. Allah's command is be and it is. Allah commanded be and his spirit speaks well. Allah doesn't have a spirit, nor is Allah a spirit. It's created, it's created being. So when Allah is speaking about blowing, that the Prophet ﷺ gave us in a variety of different hadith, that it is the angel which blows, the angel blows. But Allah refers to it as his blowing just as a means of showing the special quality of the spirit entering. It is ultimately by his command. Just as he says in the Quran, وَمَا رَمَيْتَكِ إِذْ رَمَيْتَ وَلَكِنَّ اللَّهَ رَمَى. That in reference to Prophet ﷺ before the Battle of Badr, he picked up some sand. Right? The enemy was hundreds of yards away on the opposite side of the valley, and he threw the sand at them. Thus at them. And they reported afterwards that before the battle they all felt dust in their eyes, they were all rubbing their eyes. Where it came from, they didn't say it. There was no dust storm. Allah caused it to reach them. So Allah describes the throwing of the Prophet as his throwing. And that, when Allah referred to it as his spirit, Allah uses the reference of his to elevate the status of some parts of his creation, just as Allah refers to the camel of Prophet Saleh as Na'atullah, the Lord's camel. Nobody gets any image in his mind that this is Allah's camel, meaning literally, you know, as Saleh has a camel, you have a camel, Allah has a camel. No, nonsense. Allah refers to it as his camel, showing that this camel is a special camel amongst the camels of the earth. Similarly, he refers to Jibreel as his spirit also. In Surah Maryam, etc., it refers to. So, this terminology, when Allah refers to things as being his, it is known, sometimes it refers to parts of his creation that he has ennobled by calling it his, and sometimes it literally refers to himself, Allah's mercy, Rahmatuhu. You know, of course, this is not in that same context. When Allah refers to his mercy, he's talking about Allah. But when he talks about his camel, he talks about his earth, he talks about his prophet, then it's referring to parts of his creation that he has elevated. So this is a proper understanding of this verse. However, the point still remains that from this concept, the Sufis, Sufi movement, mystical movement, promoted the idea of everything being Allah, Allah being everything, people can become Allah. And the most famous individual among them was one of the saints in the hierarchy, is Al-Hallaj. Everybody heard about Al-Hallaj, who, when he was, you know, he claimed that he was Allah saying, Ana al-Haq, right? Of course, Allah refers to himself as what was Hoffman, what he fundamentally is saying is a lie. That's what he's implying here. And when he was asked to recant his beliefs, he was called before a tribunal of Muslim judges and asked to recant his beliefs, he stood up amongst them and opened his garment and said, there's nothing inside this garment except Allah. Not backing down. In his book called Kitab al-Tawasin, he writes, if you do not recognize God, at least recognize His signs. I am the created truth, and al-Haq, because through the truth, I am eternal truth. My friends and teachers are Iblis and Pharaoh. He's telling you, right? It's very clear. I mean, for us, that's enough. He's telling you, his friends and teachers are Iblis and Pharaoh, that's enough. But he's got this whole philosophical thing which, you know, the group amongst them have taken it to mean something else. He said Iblis was threatened by the hellfire, yet he did not recant. Pharaoh was drowned in the sea, he did not recant, for he acknowledged nothing between himself and God. And I, although I am killed and crucified, though my hands and feet are cut off, I do not recant. So, what's he saying? He's saying here that Iblis, when Allah told Iblis to bow to Adam, Iblis refused to bow. He didn't recognize Adam as being God, a God to be bowed to. So this was, he said, this was the act of Tawheed. That's what they argued. Iblis was, you know, reiterating his belief in Tawheed, so he refused to bow. And Pharaoh, no, of course, Pharaoh said, Ana Rabbukum al-A'la, I am your Lord Most High. Pharaoh said, there is. Pharaoh recognizing that there's no God besides him, you know. He and God are one. And of course, you know, when the Islamic court found this individual just totally unrepentant, they took him out and cut his head off. And if you read in the books of the Sufis, right, they will describe the miracle which took place. They say when his head was cut off, it rolled on the ground saying, Analhaq, Analhaq, Analhaq. So as it was rolling. They write this stuff. So for them, this is just confirmation of that belief, you know. It's like in the time of Ali radiallahu anhu, when he caught some of his companions or some of the people who were claiming to be his followers attributing to him divinity, right? This was introduced by Abdullah ibn Sabah, right? The Jewish supposed convert to Islam from Yemen. When he caught some of them who they're giving him attributes of Allah, and he set them on fire. He killed them by burning them alive. When they were tied up and being burnt, they said, now we know for certain that you are Allah, because only Allah punishes with fire. It's that same kind of state of affairs, right? So, I mean, for us, in terms of Halaj's head rolling and saying Al-Haq, I mean, it's not really a problem. You know, if it's true, if it's not mythology that they made up, if it's true that his head rolled and kept saying Al-Haq, it's not a problem for us. Because Allah tells us in the Quran the story of As-Samiri. If you reflect back on that story, what is Allah telling us in that story? When Prophet Musa went up to receive the commandment, and he left Harun behind, may God's peace and blessing be upon them, and a Samiri amongst them got the people to melt their gold, and he made this calf, right? He claimed he saw an angel walk in and picked up the dust from the footprint of the angel and threw it on the in the mix, right? They're mixing up to make the calf. When the calf was formed and the people stood before the calf said, moo. Of course, the people all dropped down in sujood, you know, bowed to this calf, because the calf was mooing. knowing, you know, was the calf actually going and moving? No. The jinn can go inside the calf and make the sounds. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the phenomenon last year of Ganesh, right? You know, the elephant head god of the Hindus. All over India, this elephant head god who they normally, you know, in part of their rituals, the worshiping rituals, they pour milk over their god, right? The head of the god, right? And they pour it in the mouth. But normally the milk is just pour down the side. But one day, they're pouring the milk in the mouth of the elephant head god. It wasn't going down the sides anymore. He was drinking. He was drinking all over India. Even in Dubai, we have a temple there, Hindu temple in Dubai. And he was there. People were lining up to see him. And I hear in England here, he was drinking milk up here too. So, you know, for us, it's not a problem, you know. I mean, if there's not a hoax going on behind it, I mean, we're not saying we're just going to accept it just like that. But if it is real, if there is reality to it, then understanding the jinn, how the jinn operates, is not a problem for us to understand these kind of phenomena. Because the jinn can interfere in our world in this fashion. Among the Christians, you know, they have what is known as stigmata. Stigmata is that every year around this time, right, or over the centuries, around this time, Easter, right, there are some Christians who blood will start to appear in the middle of their palms. Starts to come out in the middle of their palms and their feet. Middle of the feet, you know, sometimes around the head. Blood just starts to appear. Where does this come from? And for them, this is confirming. This is, you know, Jesus on the cross. He had the, you know, the nails in this. Even though, you know, a number of Christian historians argue that really he wasn't nailed and his arms were tied and a variety of other things, you know. But the general images on the cross, you know, blood coming. So this confirms for them their belief, false belief in Jesus being God. And this again, for us, no problem. Agency of the jinn. Of course, as I said, historically, anytime this happened to an individual in the past, the Roman Catholic Church, after that person died, or even during the person's lifetime, would declare that person to be a saint. Because this is a miracle. It so happens that about 15 years ago in America, a little black American girl had this. Guess what? She wasn't declared a saint. Anyway, the point is that this belief, as we said, whether it is from the Sufis or it's from Hindus or it's from Christianity, in the end, it relates back to the inability, their inability to conceive of God creating from nothing. This is the bottom line. And for us, as Muslims, we don't have any problem with this. Before God created the world, God commanded it to be, and it was. From nothingness. This is our belief. We have no problem with it. Now, there is a question which usually is raised concerning this. In defense, this is raised by both Christians and Hindus, others who believe that God became man. The question is, isn't God able to do all things? The question. If a Christian throw that on you. You try to explain to him, no, Jesus wasn't God, and so on, so on, so on. And he said, couldn't God become Jesus if he wanted to? Question. We know in the Quran, Allah says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ. Verily Allah is able to do all things. So as a Muslim, usually, we've got our back up against the wall now. We have to admit, yes, Allah is able to do all things. So this is their judgment, this is their argument, and then really the thing ends. Well, actually, this is a mistaken understanding on our own part. Because we shouldn't have answered to them yes. We have to qualify that. It's not just a blanket yes. Yes, Allah is able to do all things. No, it's qualified. Because when Allah describes the heresy of the Christians believing that Allah is the Son, Allah says, وَلَيْنْ بَغِي. You know, it's not befitting that He has a Son. It doesn't befit God that He has a Son. So what it's saying, what it's referring to here, is that when we say Allah is able to do all things, we do not include in that statement absurdities. The absurdities, the things which are nonsensical, things which are totally illogical, contradict all sense. Meaning, that same person who says, for now, since you can know how to deal with this, the person says to you, yes, I believe Allah can do all things. You ask him, God can do all things. Well, do you believe that God is without beginning?
Yes, God.
Do you believe that God doesn't die?
Yes.
God is without beginning or end. This is part of the generally accepted definition of God. Eternal. He is eternally living without beginning or end. So then, you ask that same person who agrees that God is without beginning or end. Can God be born? No. They're stuck. They have to say no. Because you just said that God, what means to me, be God means to me, you're not born. It's without beginning. They have to say yes. God can. Because what happens is that this is what the atheist philosophers used to do to mess up the minds of the Christian theologians. They would come to them and say the same thing. You believe that God is able to do all things? Yes, it's what we hope. God is able to do all things. Can God create a stone which is too heavy for it to lift? Christian theologian, his head is spinning now, you know. He's got a problem, yes? He needs to say yes, you know, because God is able to do all things. But he, logically, you know, he says the stone is too heavy for it to lift. Well, the stone is greater than God in that sense, isn't it? I mean, stuck. Dilemma. Right? So it's the same kind of rationalization we bring to him here. We say to him, can God be born? I have to say no. Yes. Obviously not. Because we say, God means the one without beginning. Can God die? No. Because that's what it means to be God. If he died, he wasn't God. So these and all the things like them are the absurdities that are not included when we say God is able to do all things. Included with that is God becoming man. That is among the absurdities. Because God is the creator. This is his attribute of being the creator, who is uncreated. Right? Uncreated, because if he had a beginning, then he was created. If he's without beginning, means he's uncreated. Eternal, uncreated. He is the Creator. So for God to become a man, man is created, part of the creation, in need of a Creator. So it's a contradiction in terms. How can the Creator become his creation? If he became his creation, he would be in need of a Creator, and he's no longer the Creator. The one who created him was the Creator, not him. This is a contradiction. So it is an absurdity to propose or to suppose that God could become a man. Absurdity. Similarly, God having a son. This is another absurdity. Because to conceive of it, you know, you explain to them in simple, very basic terms, you tell them, listen, when a cat has a baby, called a kitten, we have a little cat. When a cow has a baby, we call a calf, which is a little cow. When a man has a baby, or a child, a little man, a big man, little man. Now when God has a son, what do you call that? A little God. So you have a big God and a little God. It's absurd. You're already putting it in the realm of two gods. Absurd. And absurd because all of these concepts, really, what it does is it is making God like his creation. Making God like his creation. This is the essence of it. They're trying to conceive of God through his creation. This is why the Christian, when he wants to argue with you about the Trinity, he wants to defend his Trinity, he says, God's like an egg. Egg. God is like an egg. There's a shell. There's the white of the egg. There's the yolk. Three parts. But it's one egg. Three gods in one. We tell them, no, God's not like an egg. Egg is an egg. God is unique, you know. It's not an egg. Or they'll come to you and they say, God's like a tree. Tree. Yes, you know, the tree, it has branches. It has a trunk. You know, the middle part. And it has roots in the ground. One tree, though. So it has these three parts that make up the one tree. Nonsense. God is not a tree. So you're making God like his creation. It's all part of that inability, as he said, to conceive of God beyond his creation. Related to that also is the concept of the intermediary. The intermediary between man and God. Prayers said through Jesus or through the idols of the Hindus. They said it's a means of focusing their prayers to God. Or amongst ignorant Muslims, prayers through or to Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam or the saints. When they want to explain this to you about the need for prayer through Jesus, in Jesus' name, or through the saints, the name of the saints, they explain it this way. They say, listen, now if you want to go and meet the Prime Minister of England, you cannot go down to Downing Street and knock on the door and say, listen, I'd like to have a chat with you. It doesn't work like that. You have to go to the MP, you know, member of parliament, and, you know, you go work your way through. Even to get to the MP, you can't just go. You have to go through other channels in the party, and eventually your word will be carried to the president or the prime minister. Same way, you're dirty with sins, committing all these sins every day. How can you then try to communicate with God? God who is pure. You must go through a pure soul like Jesus or Muhammad
abundant or a saint, this is the way to do it. Of course, Allah is very clear in the Quran, "Ud'uni astajib lakum." You call on me, and I'll answer your prayer. Finish. Simple. We don't need any intermediaries. And that said, what caused them to get into that is this trying to conceive of God in terms of His creation, either as human beings or portions of nature. You know, God is an egg. It's that type of thing. So in summary, the concept of God becoming man is the crux of the matter in our discussions with non-Muslims. Those who have belief in God. Of course, you're dealing with atheists or whatever, then you have a different angle. This is only specifically for those who have belief in God. Whether they're Hindus or whether they're Christians, this is the crux of the matter. To tackle the issue of God becoming man. Why do they have to believe? Why do you have to believe that God became man? If you believe as a Christian He became man one time, what about the Hindus who say He became man a whole bunch of times? Why stop at one? You know, once you open that door, you can't close it. So, we have to look at the issue. Why do you have to believe in the first place that God became? Then, tackling that, try to show them that it really, in fact, is an absurdity, an absurd concept. And it relates back to their inability to grasp God creating from nothing. And that's with the starting point. And that is God. God who creates from nothing. That aspect of creation is unique to God. Only God creates from nothing. All of our creations are always manipulations of things existing. But God creates from nothing. And that is unique. And that's what we have to recognize. He has no beginning, that is unique. All other things have beginnings. He doesn't die. That is unique. All other things die. He doesn't have parts. That is unique. The egg has the parts, the tree has the parts, everything else. All the things in creation are made up of parts. There's nothing that is a pure unity without having parts. Now they used to think the atom was it. And they got down into the atom. Oh, we have electrons, protons, and neutrons. So okay, electrons, protons, this is it now. Final particle. And went, oh, neutrinos. Something else. And they went, okay, that's it. Neutrinos, the smallest particle. Quarks. No. You know, the deeper they go, the more everything they find is made up of other things. There's nothing in the creation that is a pure unity. That is Allah, the creator. A pure unity, indivisible, not made up of parts, having no beginning or end. May second thing shape. That is Allah. وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَحَدٌ. That's the summary of the topic this evening. Topic, as I said, it is geared towards da'wah, dealing with those who believe that God becomes or became man. I hope, inshallah, that it has shed some light on how to tackle this tricky subject. Especially when they back us up against the wall saying, isn't Allah able to do all things? This is usually the crux that they're bringing back up to the right hand, you know, whatever, right cross. Now you know how to deal with it, you know, give it a block.
So, JazakAllah khairan for a very enlightening talk, mashallah. We've got about 15 minutes of questions. We'll try to, inshallah, get through as much as possible. First question, which is very relevant, inshallah, let the Lord fit it through the hour, inshallah.
One of the people who claim that Muslims worship the Kaaba, what do we tell them? Yeah, you'll find it, you know,
Hindus would say same thing. I mean, the philosophical Hindu. The average Hindu, you ask him, why are you worshipping that God? He said, because I believe this is God. This is God. But you made it with your own hands. It's okay, but it's still God. You know, like Abraham's father and the people. But the philosophical Hindu, you know, the guru, he will tell you, well, listen, no, we're not worshipping this actual image that you see here. It's only for the focus of worship. The focus of worship is to be philosophical. We have to ask him, what about that thing called again, Lingam? How are you focusing on this kind of worship? For those who don't know, you know, for Hindus, their favorite form of their popular deity, Vishnu, is as an erect deity called Lingam. And they worship it in, you know, big forms, and they carry it around, and, you know, pour milk over the top of it and all these things. Major Banaras is where they come for yearly worship. They have pilgrimage there to worship. What kind of focus is this? You say you guys are out of focus, really. Out of focus. So they say, well, okay, same way, that's what you're doing with the Kaaba. You know, you're there you are. You say you're not worshiping the Kaaba, but there you are, bowing down to the Kaaba. All around the world, you all bow down to the Kaaba. But we say, really, you know, this is only for organization in worship. Our worship involves standing, bowing, kneeling, all these things. You know. If we didn't have one unified direction in which we pray, people would be bouncing into each other. You know, this keeps everything in order. We're all in the same direction in rows. You know, it's for ordering our worship. It's only a direction of prayer. And to prove it to you, a couple of times a year, they open the door and they go inside and pray. Do you go inside your idols and pray? No. But the idea is to be blasphemy, you know, to go open up your idol and go pray inside the idol? No. That's a lie. Okay. So this is, you know, for us to show, no, this is just a house of worship. And the back part of the Kaaba, you know, which is indicated by the that semicircular wall, the inside area they call Hijr Ismail, that part is actually an extension of the Kaaba. The original Kaaba included all of that. It was in the Quraysh time that they ended up with the cube form. They built it taller, ran out of money, and couldn't finish it, so they just put the wall there to indicate the remainder of it. So when you go, that's why when you're making tawaf, you're not allowed to go between the Kaaba and that semicircular wall. There's an opening there if you wanted to walk through, but it would not be considered tawaf. Incorrect. You must go on the outside of it, because inside there is considered part of the Kaaba. And people go there and they pray inside. Anybody can go and pray inside. And the actual Kaaba itself, the building, the final building, is opened up. People go inside and pray. So we say this is clear evidence that this only represents a direction for prayer for organization of worship purposes, and it is not an object of worship. In fact, someone said, tell them, and told us that one of the signs of the last day is that an Ethiopian with skinny legs, and this has nothing against Ethiopians, will go to Mecca and break down the Kaaba. What's going to happen then? Does it mean the Muslims stop worshiping if the Kaaba is broken down? No.
Two questions relating to the Jews. One is, can you please explain the shirk that Jews do? And then the other question, which is similar, in your book, The Fundamentals of Tawheed, you say Judaism is a subtle form of idolatry. Please explain.
Well, as I said, the Jews really don't need to spend much time with them, because it's only such a small minority, you know. But just the issue of shirk in their worship, it is in their representations of God. God for them is their servant. Well, you have to be there. Yeah. He is their servant. He does what they want him to do. You know? They describe him in the Old Testament as repenting for what he sought to do about against the Jews. Repenting to them. Asking their forgiveness. In the Talmud, he asked permission from the rabbis. Can we do this? Can I do that? What kind of God is this? The God of Israel, is their God who does whatever they want him to do. So this is where the shirk comes. They portray God
not only as a human being in the Garden of Eden, Adam hears his footsteps, and then God is asking, "Where are you, Adam? Where are you?" That's the way Adam is. Besides all these silly kind of portrayals of God, I mean, they do make God, as I said, their servant by giving him attributes of human beings weaker than themselves.
Another question. In the field of Dawah, is it enough that we know Islam fully, or we need to know the beliefs of other people in detail, or how would you prioritize it?
Well, the most important thing is to know Islam properly. Because if we don't know other people's beliefs, but we're able to tell them what Islam is, and they will listen to us, alhamdulillah, that's good. That's good enough, really, ultimately. We know Islam properly, we can explain when they ask questions, etc. Then this is the fundamental. This is most important, because that will save them, and it will save us. I would not advise anybody, you know, to specialize in, you know, Didat arguments and all the different reading of all the different religions, and they neglect their own knowledge of Islam, of course not. But having studied and, you know, gotten a good solid foundation, for a person involved in Dawah, it is important to know something of the beliefs of the people that you're dealing with. Because the da'i, the propagator, is like a doctor. You know, the doctor, when the patient walks in the door, he doesn't start writing the prescription right away. Although I did experience this when I was in Saudi Arabia. You know. You're not supposed to, right? Not supposed to. But, you know, proper doctor, he's got to sit you down and find out, you know, what's wrong with you. And after he's found out your illness, etc., then he will give you the suitable medicine to deal with your sickness. So the same way the diet functions like this, you know, whenever it is possible, you should find out what the people are thinking, what is on their mind, what is their, you know, what are their problems, what is the issues, what has brought them to the point that they're in right now. And by understanding that, then we can give them the necessary or the suitable remedy to clarify for them what is lacking.
Okay. There's another question here relating to the Mormons from Utah, and apparently they're very heavily subsidized. They stay here for 2 years and spread their kufr around. So could you enlighten us a bit about them, inshallah, a bit about their beliefs? And
about their beliefs, and also the fact that Mormons have this uncomfortable thing with many black people, because it's part of their beliefs to say we're cursed by God. So they're trying to tread water and you know, trying to explain it, because this is part of their belief that all black people are actually cursed by God.
Although that's been modified already, you see. Yeah, it's been corrected, you know. Their belief is that their elders who run the organizations are prophets, right? They receive revelation. Because, you know, of course, the early Mormons, they were polygamists in the wildest senses. They would have like 20, 30, 40 wives, you know? And they were functioning. Even till today, you can still, ones who didn't submit to the changes, right? You know, in about the, I think it was the 30s or so, the American government threatened them to take away statehood from them, take over their states, unless they cancel this polygamy. So, shortly after that, the elders received revelation that the polygamy was now canceled. But some of their followers, they didn't agree. They said, no, we're not going with this one, right? So they just kept on going. So I've seen, when I'm back in Canada, I saw some programs that I interviewed with Mormons. This guy's got 13, 14 different wives. And he's the, you know, it's like he's running a factory, all the wives are out working and everything, he's just, you know, the administrator, right? So they have, you know, their beliefs and things have been modified, changed all along. And similarly, this idea about blacks, you know, blacks could not become elders or could not become even ministers. They have another name for their ministers. But they couldn't reach the stage, they could only be followers, just name it. And they wouldn't be included. They have a particular mountain vault in which the names of all the Mormons are kept, you know, and their marriages are kept intact for the next life, and, you know, they're looking up, like the pharaohs and stuff. They have a similar thing. You know, now they have been integrated. So they had received new revelation, which removed the curse.
Okay.
Well, the curse on of Ham, right, on the son of Noah, right, and the Talmud actually goes into more detail, you know, about being cursed to be the hewers of wood and the drawers of water for his brothers and so on and so forth. But you see, there is nothing in the Bible that says Ham is black. Actually, I mean, but of course we don't believe in that anyway, this curse business. But I'm saying. But it's been typically put, you know, that's why the Hamites end up being, in their biblical history, they end up saying that these are the black people are descendants of the Hamites, right? So.
Another question. Could you please clarify whether Ibn Taymiyyah, rahimahullah, allowed one particular form of fana that some Muslims keep quoting?
Well, I don't know. I would not imagine that he accepted the principle of fana as taught by Sufism. He did speak about people who, in amongst the Sufis, who on hearing Allah's name, you know, fell into a faint. They would go unconscious, right? I mean, he didn't, prohibit it, but he pointed out that this was not a better state or a superior state, something to be sought. He pointed out that this was a weakness on their part, because the Sahaba were not known to do this. Allah's name was mentioned, nobody was fainting when Allah's name was mentioned. You know, they went and made jihad. You know, they established the Islam, you know, to the ends of the earth. So he identified some of these things. There are certain aspects of Sufism, not because he went and was exposed to Sufi teachings. I mean, everybody in those days, and a number of times after, everybody went through Sufi teachings, just part of your normal training. You see, many of the scholars of that time, they used to have after their name, you know, they would have Maliki, right, to indicate their fiqh madhab. They would have Ash'ari, to indicate their philosophical madhab. And they'd have, you know, Naqshbandi, to indicate their Sufi madhab. You know, the name would be a series of ease and ease and ease, right? So it was very common. Vast majority of the scholars, you know, claim, oh, they passed through this phase in the course of their learning. But they grew beyond it and realized it was false and left it behind. You know? But where there was certain good in it, Ibn Taymiyyah identified it, because this was how Ibn Taymiyyah was. You know, whenever if there are some people and they have some deviation or some error, where there is good, he would give credit to the good. Where there was wrong, he would identify it as being wrong and seek to correct it. This is amongst people who have not gone outside of Islam. And people who still remain amongst the middle of who had, you know, some incorrect ideas.
There's another question here which I think is particularly relevant to Pakistani, is how to approach to Muslims praying through the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his family. If you have some advice on that.
Of course, this, you know, in Dawah, as a general principle, there is no one way. There is no one way to approach. This is going to vary from person to person, from family to family. The point is that one has to have some kind of relationship with the people we're trying to communicate with, some kind of openness that they're willing to accept. And when that openness is there, which can be built through, you know, friendships, through doing treating people, you know, kindly, etc., etc. Once we have that relationship, then they can be introduced, you know, through the Quran, through the Hadith, through different statements of Prophet ﷺ, statements of Allah. Also, there are lectures done by, you know, some scholars who speak their language, you know, and are very effective in bringing their ideas across. So you can get these tapes for them. Let them listen to it.
Well, there's another question here. do you think the Shias worship a man or Allah or themselves?
Well, the Shia, as a group in general, they have given the attributes of Allah to the Imams. You know, they've gone, actually, the Christians have stepped further. For the Christians, you know, the Pope, when he is vested with the office of papacy, or the papal office, he becomes infallible. But you need to, if you're dealing with Catholics, you get there's a book on the market called The Bad Popes. You want to raise a question about this infallibility, get that book called The Bad Popes. And this stuff, historical stuff that the popes were involved in, you know, all kinds of, you know, fornication and corruption and really wild stuff. These people were infallible. You have to ask them, what is this? But anyway, for the Catholics, you know, the Pope, when he becomes the Pope, he becomes infallible. He makes his edicts and his laws. He cannot make mistakes. He's guided by the Holy Spirit, God's representative on earth. For the Shia, they go, the Catholics, one better. They have 12 infallible. So the 12 Imams. Right? And they include Fatima as number 13. Right? These are the infallibles. But they go beyond that of the Catholics. Because the Catholics say that the Pope is infallible when he receives the office of papacy. Before that, he was fallible, making mistakes. But for the Imams, they are infallible from birth. Incapable of any error, either inwardly or outwardly. Accidentally or deliberately. Totally incapable of error. This is Allah. So they were given the attribute, his attribute, which is of Allah. Allah is the one who makes no mistakes. Prophet ﷺ said, every descendant of Adam makes mistakes. Kulli bani Adam, khata. This is it. So they have given this status of pure infallibility, which belongs only to Allah, they've given it to human beings.
Why sometimes the
Muslim sorry, can we address that some other time, maybe in the panel session or something, you can bring that up, inshallah. We've just got two more questions, we're actually shooting over time as well, but inshallah they don't mind too much. Is there a special way of handling the Jehovah Witnesses because they tend to be the most difficult and persistent?
Jehovah's Witnesses. Wickedness. Jehovah's Witness. There are different ways. If you are familiar with their background, their history, then you can point out that their leaders had predicted that the world was going to end in 1917. Yeah. And this is why they got many followers in the beginning, back started in the late 1800s, right? Because they were what they call a millennial cult. And they're talking about the end of the world is at hand, nigh, around the corner. 1917, because they started saying that back in about 1880, you know, so it was some years away. So in 1917, everybody was waiting. 1917 came and passed. People left. You know. Then the remainder made a new taxi here, an explanation. Oh, it was, Jesus came down to the lower heavens, you know, something like this, right? Then again, they set another date, 1930-something. Again, they're waiting for 1930.
Documented.
Yes. Okay, not just one time, but about four or five times. Finally, you know, a few years back, they gave up. Because one of the explanations that our calculations went right. You know, we were making it based on these calculations and the Greek word letters and Hebrew and, you know, okay, it's a new calculation. They did this about three, four times, didn't work. Finally, they said they've given up on the calculations. You know, God knows. So they finally dropped it. But there was about, there at least five times that they set dates for the end of the world, which didn't happen.
Okay, last question is, some of this believe Allah is everywhere. Can you talk about this subject and just elaborate a little bit, inshallah, on the notion of Allah being everywhere?
I think given our short space of time, it's not really... It's too big a topic to try to deal with.
Yeah, well, we'll answer that. We'll put it over to the panel session, inshallah.
And the detailed answer of it can be found. I have this whole chapter in my book called The Fundamentals of Tawheed, which is available here. called Al-Ulu, the transcendency of Allah. And it deals, you know, with all the arguments that support that, and then showing from Quran and Sunnah why this is invalid.
Okay, I'd just like to remind the brothers that the women will be using the bookshop between, in fact now in fact, quarter two to quarter past, so obviously exercise caution in that area. And the other question